help for this to pass into your hands. I think he was worried that if Grace outlived him, she would make no provision for you. He smiled. Bill was obviously an intelligent man. We know how that turned out, don't we?
I grinned back. She did give me 80 grand a year.
Only at my insistence, he shot back. I told her that if she didn't make some gesture, you would probably contest the will and might well end up with a fortune.
That must have turned her stomach.
Damned right it did. Bill wanted these arrangements kept secret until after Grace's death. I think he was worried that she might challenge it and crush you with legal fees. With her gone and satisfied of your integrity, everything is now in place.
He reached into the file and took out a bundle of documents.
The first part of Bill's arrangement relates to a property in Soho. Have you ever seen it?
I've never even heard of it, I replied.
It's an old tea warehouse with a cast-iron facade and a huge space inside. Several people have said it would make a magnificent home. Why they would say that, I have no idea.
Finbar, a widower with no kids, lived in a 14-room pre-war co-op in Park Avenue's most elite white-glove building, so I wasn't surprised that he thought a converted warehouse was one step above a garbage skip.
Bill had it made airtight and put in sophisticated humidity, fire, and air conditioning systems. This building and all its contents are what he wanted you to have.
He gave the bundle and a sheaf of other documents to the two wise men, and they started signing and witnessing them. What contents? I asked. Finbar smiled.
Bill was very orderly, a completely rational man, but in one segment of his life he never disposed of anything.
The art, I interrupted, caught between shock and wonder.
That's right, Finbar replied. As you may know, there was hardly an unknown artist he didn't support by buying their work, sometimes whole exhibitions.
He told me once, I said, that most people's idea of charity was to give money to the United Way. He supported starving artists.
And that's exactly what he did, year after year, check after check. But he had the eye, Scott. That was the remarkable thing. And he kept everything he bought.
In the tea warehouse?
That was why he converted it. He stacked it inside like lumber. Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Hockney, Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg, the list is endless. This is an inventory.
He pushed a printout across to me, and I leafed through it. Every page was littered with what had become household names. What about Grace? After Bill died, she never asked about any of it.
As I said, she had no interest. I think at some stage he must have told her that he'd sold whatever he still owned, and the proceeds had gone into one of the trusts.
He slid another thick document across the desk.
Naturally, I had to keep the canvases insured, and that meant regular valuations. This is the most recent information.
I took the list and saw that next to each canvas was its estimated value. On the last page, it had been totaled. I stared at the figure and saw that I was a very wealthy man. Maybe not as rich as Cameron, but over halfway there. The three men watched as I got to my feet and walked to the window. The rain was starting to hit, and I couldn't tell whether it was that or the tears in my eyes that was clouding my view. Even at the end of his life, when he was doubting my character, Bill had tried to take care of me. What more could I have asked? He was a wonderful man, and once again I realized I should have treated him better. I turned and looked at Finbar, and he handed me all the documents, signed, sealed, and delivered.
"Congratulations," he said. "You're now the owner of one of the finest collections of contemporary art in the world."
Chapter 27. Alone, sitting in a budget hotel in a back street of Bodrum, writing my last will and testament, I had to decide what would happen to a treasure trove of canvases which most museum curators would die for. The collection was completely intact. Although I had spent a lot of time in the silence of the tea warehouse, wandering among the towering racks of paintings, pulling out masterly works that nobody had seen in decades. I had never sold any of them. They were too much a part of Bill, and my feelings about them, as well as the wealth they represented, were still far too raw for me to deal with. Strangely, though, the disposition of them in the event of my death presented no problem to me. I figured the answer must have been bubbling away on the back burner of my mind for hours, if not longer. I wrote that I wanted the Museum of Modern Art to be given 100 canvases of their choice, on condition that they put them on permanent display. I directed that they should also be granted the folio of Rauschenberg drawings that was the reason Bill and I had visited Strasbourg so long ago. I then described the photograph of the peasant woman and her children walking to the gas chamber that I had seen at the Natzweiler death camp, the photo that had haunted so many of my dreams, and requested that the museum acquire a copy of it. I said that the rest of the canvases, including the warehouse in which they were stored, were to be sold and the proceeds used to endow a William J. Murdoch home for orphaned Roma or gypsy children. I then came to the most difficult part of the exercise. In conclusion, I said, I wanted the Museum of Modern Art to mount a small display at the entrance to whatever gallery featured the 100 works. The display should consist of the Rauschenberg drawings, the copy of the photo from the death camp, and the following dedication. Bequeathed to the people of New York in memory of Bill. I sat very still for a long time, and then laid my pen down. I was unsure what to say next, incapable of finding the words that would do proper honor to Bill's memory. I thought of us driving up through the pine forest of the Vosges Mountains. I remembered the crouching evil of the gas chamber. I felt again the strength of him as I slipped my hand unbidden into his. I saw the instant happiness in his eyes as he looked down at me, and suddenly I knew the words that would mean everything to my foster father. Bequeathed to the people of New York in memory of Bill Murdoch, by his loving son Scott. I finished by appointing Finbar Hanrahan, counsel at law of Park Avenue, and James Balthasar Grosvenor, president of the United States, as executors. I figured if I was going to die for my country, it was the least he could do. I called down to the front desk, heard the young duty manager's sleep-addled voice, and asked him to come to my room. Without letting him see the content of the document, I had him witness my signature, and I then sealed it in an envelope and addressed it to Finbar. I put that envelope inside another, scrawled Ben's name on it, and a note. In the event of my death, please deliver the enclosed letter by hand when you return to New York. I slipped it under the door of Ben's darkened room and went back to my own. I locked the door, kicked off my shoes, and lay fully clothed on the bed. In the stillness of the night, two lines from an old poem whose name or author I couldn't remember drifted into my head. I slept and dreamed that life was beauty. I woke and found that life was duty. Life was duty. Like any soldier going into battle, I thought of the conflict that lay ahead. To be honest, I didn't hope for success or glory. I just hoped that I would equip myself with honor and courage. Chapter 28. 11 o'clock in the morning. Barely a cloud in the sky, unseasonably warm for that time of year, and Kamali arrived right on time. I was waiting on the sidewalk in front of the hotel, dressed in trainers, a pair of chinos, and a summery shirt flapping loose. A perfect look for a picnic, I thought. The Beretta was tucked into the back of my trousers, but it was there purely for decoration, part of the legend of an unwitting covert agent. I knew it couldn't save me and that I would lose it the moment I got jumped. The chinos had deep pockets, and that was why I had chosen them. The real weapon was in one of them, and by slouching forward, acting relaxed, hands buried in my pockets, I could keep my hand on it. The black Fiat pulled to a stop, and I saw that Kamali was alone. If I needed any confirmation about what was really happening, she had just given it to me. Smiling warmly, I went to open the front passenger's door. It was locked, and she indicated the rear seat. Apparently, it was okay for a Muslim woman to lead a man to his death, but not to share the front seat with him. I opened the rear door and climbed in. "Where's the little guy?" I asked.
"It's a field trip for kids from the school," she replied, "and he's been allowed to go along. We'll be joining them for the picnic. He wants to show off his American friend."
As an actress, she was a good cop. She had thought too much about the lines, and they came out stilted. "What sort of field trip?" I asked, carrying on like everything was fine.
"Archaeology. Dumb ruins, as the kids say."
She laughed, and it seemed to ease her anxiety.
"An interesting place. I think you'll enjoy it."
Somehow, I doubted that. "Is it far?"
"A fair distance by car," she said, "but I've got a share in a half-cabin cruiser. If you don't mind being deckhand, it's quicker and a more spectacular sight. Then we can bring my son back the same way. He loves the boat."
Somebody knew what they were doing. It was easy to tail a car, but a boat was almost impossible. The field of vision was too expansive, and there was no traffic to hide amidst. They were making certain I didn't have help following me. "Sounds cool," I said. I wasn't feeling it. Despite my years of training, despite the plans I had laid, I felt the tendrils of fear unfurl and tighten around my throat. It isn't an easy thing to do, to walk knowingly into harm's way. Kamali turned the wheel and headed down into a hidden cove with an old jetty and a few dozen small boats at anchor. Because I was sitting in the back, I hadn't been able to see whether she had brought with her the one piece of equipment that was crucial to my plan. If she hadn't, I was going to have to abort. "Have you got your phone?" I asked.
"Why?"
she replied, alert, looking into the rearview mirror, scanning my face. I shrugged. "We don't want to be on a sinking boat waving for help, do we?" She smiled as the anxiety receded.
"Of course."
She fumbled at the waistband of her jeans and held it up. The mission was on. There was no turning back now. She pulled into a parking spot, and I unbuckled my seatbelt. "Anything to unload?"
"There's a picnic basket in the trunk. I don't drink alcohol, but I brought some beer, and there's plenty of food. Help yourself."
The condemned man ate a hearty meal, I thought, and almost laughed. I realized the stress and fear were starting to get the better of me, and made myself lock it down. I pulled the picnic basket out of the trunk and turned to follow Kamali onto the jetty. She was crouching to cast off the mooring line from a little half-cabin launch, old and wooden-hulled, but well-maintained. I wondered how much it had cost them to rent it for the day. She stood up and, unaware that she was being observed, paused to stare at the small cove. It was beautiful in the morning light. The turquoise water, the deserted beach, the whitewashed houses. And in a moment of epiphany, I realized that she was imprinting it on her memory, saying goodbye. I had wondered earlier if I had panicked her enough, and I saw now that the threat of bright light in a Bulgarian orphanage had terrified her. I figured that she and the little guy would be leaving very soon with her brother, probably driving hard for the border with Iraq or Syria. Thinking about it more, I understood that if I went missing, she would be the prime suspect, and that left her little alternative. For all of us, our time in Bodrum was coming to an end. She broke free of her thoughts and stepped down into the launch's cabin. By the time I got on board and stowed the hamper, she had started the engine, powered up a small VHS radio next to the wheel, and was talking in Turkish into the mic. She put it back on the cradle and turned.
"Just letting the harbor master know where we're going, what our route is," she said.
It was a nice touch, but she wasn't talking to the harbor master. She was speaking to her brother and whoever was with him, letting them know that we were on our way. I had already worked out our destination, of course. Chapter 29. The ruins of the drowned city clung to the cliff. The old steps followed their eternal path into the sea, and the door to nowhere was a silhouette under the harsh noonday sun. Kamali had slowed down as we approached, allowing me to view the ruins in all their glory, and I had reacted with appropriate wonder, as if I had never seen them before. The cliff face and the parking area on top were as deserted as ever, and the only sound as we passed the sunken dance platform was the wailing of a few circling gulls. Their mournful cries seemed a fitting accompaniment as Kumali steered the little cruiser up to the rotting jetty. I grabbed the mooring line, swung off the deck, and made the boat secure. On the beach, host to clots of tar and the bodies of two dead gulls, hordes of crabs ran for cover like roaches in a tenement kitchen. I hated the place. Kumali came to my side, carrying the picnic basket, and I took it from her, indicating our surroundings. "It doesn't look like much of a spot for a picnic." She laughed, more relaxed now that she had got me to the designated place and her part in the plan was almost over.
"We are not picnicking here. There's a tunnel that leads into a Roman amphitheater. The experts say it's the best example in the world after the Colosseum."
I did my best impression of being pleased.
"Sounds great. Where are the kids?"
She had obviously thought of it, or her brother had.
"Already here," she said easily. "They came by bus. There's a path that comes down into it from the road."
I knew it wasn't true. The area had been reconnoitered when the hit on Finlay was being planned, and Control had warned us that, if things went wrong, not to shoot open the gate on the tunnel and try to find refuge in the ruin. It was a dead end. There was absolutely no way out.
"I'm looking forward to seeing the little guy,"
I said, as we picked our way across kelp-strewn rocks.
"He's so excited," she said. "I could barely get him to eat his breakfast."
We found a rough path that led towards a dark opening located in the side of the cliff just above the beach.
"It's the start of the tunnel," she said. "The dignitaries and generals used to arrive by barge. Accompanied by fanfares, they walked down it and into the amphitheater."
"I would have thought the place would be better known. There'd be more tourists," I suggested.
"Years ago, it was packed, but they did so much damage it's just for archaeologists and school groups now."
The lies were coming more easily to her. "What's the amphitheater called?" I asked. She said something in Turkish, which, of course, I didn't understand. "In English?"
"I don't think there's a direct translation for it. I'm not sure what it means."
I guess she didn't think it was a good idea to tell me I was about to enter a place called the Theater of Death. We stopped at the mouth of the tunnel, and I saw, half hidden in the gloom, a gate made of heavy rusted bars. If it had ever been chained and padlocked, it wasn't now. "They don't keep it locked?" I said.
"The only access is by boat, and hardly anyone knows about it. It hasn't been locked for years," she said.
That was their first mistake. I could just make out marks in the rust where a chain had been pulled free, probably cut through a few hours ago. It didn't help me, but I found it reassuring. It meant they were hurrying and overlooking details. Experience told me that would be an advantage. Kumali pushed the gate open and was about to step inside when I stopped her.
"Here, let me go first,"
I said, acting like a perfect gentleman. I think good manners are very important when you are being led to your death. It also meant that, if everything went to hell, I would have a clear field of fire in front of me. I walked through the gate, headed into the darkness, and felt the sweat start to pool around the Beretta nestled in the small of my back. I knew that at the other end of the tunnel, the Saracen was waiting. Chapter 30. Bradley hadn't encountered any difficulty in finding the right house. As planned, he had left the hotel 5 minutes after I was picked up by Kumali, and, using a detailed map I had drawn for him, walked straight to Bodrum's best-stocked store for boating supplies. 3 minutes later, he left the store carrying a plastic shopping bag, holding the one item he had purchased, and, once again, following my map, headed southwest. After 11 minutes, he turned into the street he was looking for, and saw, halfway along it, the Coca-Cola distribution warehouse. He approached it, crossed the street, and stopped in front of a small dwelling. After checking its appearance and recalling 6 items about it, He was certain he had located the correct property. He opened the gate, passed the garden gnomes, and knocked at the door. The time was 11:25. He was right on schedule. A few seconds later, he heard a woman's voice from inside calling in Turkish, and though he didn't understand the language, he was sure that she was asking, "Who is it?" He said nothing in reply, just letting the silence boil, and, as most people do in such a situation, the woman, the little guy's nanny, opened the door. Bradley's plan had been to push hard once the door was off the lock, step inside, slam it behind him, and confront the woman in the privacy of the house. It didn't work. In discussing it with Bradley, I had failed to take into account the fact that the woman was severely obese. When Bradley pushed hard on the door, it hit the stationary bulk of her and stopped. It gave the surprised young woman just enough time to push back hard and start yelling. It looked for a moment as if Bradley was going to be locked out and the whole plan would founder. Reacting fast, thank God, the cop pulled out his pistol, rammed it through the gap straight at the terrified nanny's teeth, and yelled at her to step back. She didn't recognize all the words, but she got the message. She retreated a step. Bradley scrambled inside and, still pointing the gun at her, slammed the door behind him. The woman was too scared to scream, and that gave Bradley the chance to pull a curtain aside and look out of a narrow window. To his relief, nothing was moving outside, and he realized that three Coke trucks maneuvering into the warehouse, engines roaring, had swallowed her cries. He turned back, saw that fear had really taken hold, and she was shaking hard. Before he could say anything, a face appeared out of the doorway at the back of the house and looked down the hallway at them. It was the little guy. Bradley's gun was obscured by the bulk of the woman, and he lowered it so that it was out of sight and smiled at the child. That was all the boy needed. He walked forward, grinning back, talking away in Turkish. The nanny moved to take hold of him, protective, and that, combined with Bradley's grin, seemed to calm her, and the shaking turned into a tremor rather than a full-on quake.
"What is he saying?" Bradley asked, indicating the little guy, making his voice sound as friendly as possible.
The nanny swallowed, trying to moisten her throat, and forced her mind to summon up the limited English she had acquired working for different families over the years.
"He say you American," she managed to get out.
Bradley smiled at the little guy.
"Yeah, New York."
The nanny translated for the boy, still holding him tight.
"He ask you friend of Bowing Man," she said.
Bradley looked confused. Bowing Man? What the hell was that? But the nanny came to the rescue.
"He mean FBI man."
"Ah,"
Bradley responded.
"Brody Wilson. Yeah, he's my friend."
The little guy said something, and the nanny translated for him.
"Where is the Bowing Man?"
"He's with your mom," Bradley replied.
"Where they go?"
the nanny translated for the little guy. Bradley didn't want to alarm the child and had what he thought was a good idea.
"They went on a picnic," he said.
As soon as it was translated, the boy dissolved into tears, seemingly inconsolable. Bradley had no way of knowing that it was the boy's dearest dream to go on a picnic with his American friend, and now they had left him behind. Bradley stared, confused. Through the child's tears and grief, the nanny managed to understand what the problem was and explained it for Bradley's benefit. The cop bent down, kept the gun out of sight, and told the boy that everything was okay. His mom would be coming to get him soon, but first they had to play a little game. As soon as the nanny had translated it, the boy smiled at Bradley, reassured, and gave the cop one of his best bows. Ben and Marcy had never had any kids, so Ben considered children pretty much an alien race. But he couldn't help being deeply affected by the child's desperate longing for something as simple as a picnic. He felt the revulsion well up, sickened by the prospect of what he had to do, but he also knew he had no choice. One kid's suffering was nothing compared with the carnage of smallpox, and he motioned for the nanny to lead the way down the hall. In the kitchen, he immediately drew the blinds and locked the back door. Only then did he turn his attention to its architecture. It was a traditional Bodrum house, and the kitchen, like most of its kind, had a very high, steeply raked roof to help dissipate the heat. In the middle, high above, a light hung from a beam. It was supported by a heavy brass bolt, and Bradley knew it would be perfect. He turned to the nanny, demanded her cell phone, and attached it to the charger lying on the kitchen counter. It was good thinking. If the phone ran out of juice at a critical moment, everything would fail. Speaking slowly and clearly, he told the nanny it was his absolute intention that both she and the boy would get out alive.
"It won't happen, though," he said. "If you try to escape, answer the door, or touch the phone. You will do everything I say. Understand?"
She nodded, and with that, Bradley sat down with his gun within instant reach, opened up the plastic shopping bag, and took out a large coil of thick rope. The little guy, intrigued, came and sat beside him. Together, they started to make the noose. Chapter 31. I led Kumali deeper into the tunnel. The walls decorated with fragments of ancient mosaics, huge cracks bisecting the vaulted roof from centuries of quakes, the silence pressing down on us. On either side were the ruins of what were called the hypogeum, the underground vaults and cells which housed slaves and animals used in wild beast hunts, and I felt the deep melancholy of the place surrounding me. It was as if misery had taken root in the stone. Kumali pointed at the barred pens, talking a little too fast, a little too nervously.
"The cells would only hold a few hundred people," she explained. "The huge spectacles and naval battles, which would often kill thousands of prisoners or slaves, were almost exclusive to the Colosseum. Here in the provinces, without the wealth of a Caesar, it was mostly gladiators and the recreation of famous myths. Of course, those stories were wildly popular, too. Lots of violence and killing, but not much plot."
"Sounds like a Hollywood movie," I said, through my parched lips, trying to act normal. Kumali didn't seem to hear. We turned a dogleg, came out of the tunnel, and I saw the amphitheater for the first time. Kumali had been telling the truth about it. The symmetry, the stacked decks of almost intact marble colonnades, and the sheer size of it were remarkable. So was the stillness. In the harsh midday sun, the theater of death felt like it was hushed and waiting, ready for a new performance to begin. "Where is everybody?" I asked.
"Above us," she said. "There's a platform with a great view of the arena. If we follow the colonnade, we'll find a set of steps and they'll take us up to it."
She turned to lead the way, and I glimpsed the first of them. He was standing deep in a ruined passage, unaware that, to a trained eye, darkness is often a relative thing. He was dressed in black, a pool of greater gloom in the shadow. I guessed that his job was to move behind me and cut off any chance of escape down the tunnel. I swept my eyes around the arena, acting like any interested tourist. The Saracen and his hired help would have me triangulated, and from the single data point of the hidden man, I had a good idea where the others would be. Kumali, walking a little faster, pointed to the middle of the site.
2,000 years ago, the sand on the arena floor would have been dyed a deep red," she said.
"To disguise the blood?" I asked.
"That's right."
I located another member of the team, a thick-set bull of a man, standing in a honeycomb of crumbling arches just above us. I was surprised. He was in his 60s, far too old for this rodeo, I would have thought, and there was something about him that pinged my memory, but I had no time to dwell on it. Kumali had led me into a towering, crumbling passage, a dead end, I was sure, talking all the time to allay her nerves.
"Of course, the bodies had to be removed before the next event could start. Two men dressed as mythological figures would enter the arena to supervise it. The first was supposedly Pluto, the god of the dead. He would hit the corpses with a hammer, showing that the man, woman, or child now belonged to him. The second was Mercury, who, according to myth, carried a wand and escorted souls to the underworld. In this case, the wand was a hot iron, and he would touch the bodies to see if the person was really dead.
So, even faking it was no escape.
None at all, she said.
We walked deeper into the gloom. Up ahead, sunlight was spilling through the shattered roof, and I guessed that was where I would meet Zachariah al-Nusayri face to face. My journey was almost over. I had to time everything perfectly now. I couldn't make a mistake. My life and everything else depended on it. I slipped my hands deeper into my pockets, nice and relaxed, and I was certain that the men watching me from the darkness had already registered the small bump in the waistband at the back of my trousers. They would be smiling, I thought, knowing that I wouldn't have time to get my right hand out, reach behind, draw the pistol, and start shooting.
Dumb American.
I had been taught how amateurs worked. They would be concentrating on the pistol, thinking that was where the danger lay, not worrying about my left hand, which was wrapped around the only weapon I cared about. My cell phone. It was powered on, ready to go, every button on the keypad set to speed dial the same number. Ben Bradley's phone, in his pocket, back at the nanny's house. In the seconds before the men jumped me, all I had to do was hit a button on the keypad. Any button. Bradley wouldn't answer. He would recognize the number, and it would start a countdown. Exactly 4 minutes later, he would pick up the nanny's cell phone, take it off the charger, and dial Kamali. She would look at the caller ID, see that it was the nanny, and, worried there was a serious problem with the little guy, would answer. She would then learn something that would change everything. The 4 minute gap was crucial. It was the period I had estimated would elapse between first being grabbed by the muscle and the Saracen emerging from the shadows. If his sister's cell phone rang too soon, the Saracen might realize that something was wrong and turn and vanish into the ruins. How could I coerce a man who had already run? If Kamali's phone rang too late, I was going to be in a world of trouble. The Saracen was desperate for information about the supposed traitor, and he didn't have much time. He wouldn't waste it on a polite conversation, and I figured he would have something like a 12-volt truck battery and alligator clips close at hand. As every torturer knew, that instrument was highly portable, easy to acquire, and, if you didn't mind how much damage you caused to the victim, extremely fast. I wasn't sure I would be able to hang on for very long.
4 minutes. Don't screw it up, Ben.
We passed a mound of rubble and trash. Shards of broken glass, empty beer bottles, the polished steel lid of a freezer box. Groups of kids had obviously broken in over the years and partied hard. Next to the mound was a long marble trough. Once used by the dignitaries to wash their feet, it was fed water from a stone gorgon's face. One end of the trough was broken, and I should have paid it more attention. It had been blocked with rocks, and the trough was full. But my mind was in another place. I was waiting to be attacked, waiting to hit the magic button before they had my arms pinned to my back. We stepped into the sunlight filtering through the shattered roof, and I saw that the path ahead disappeared into a huge fall of masonry. I had reached the dead end. I was trapped in a box canyon, and the index finger of my left hand was the only thing between me and disaster. Chapter 32. Wrong turn? I said, indicating the wall of rubble and turning back towards Kamali. She was no longer alone. The first of the hired help had stepped out of a side passage, blocking any escape route, not trying to hide himself, looking straight at me. It was Muscle Man, who had broken into my hotel room, still in his leather jacket and an equally tight t-shirt. Maybe it was because my senses were highly charged. Perhaps it was seeing him in the flesh, but I realized then that I had seen a photo of him long ago. Laughing on the deck of Christos Nikolaidis' converted icebreaker as it rode at anchor in Santorini. I suddenly knew which of the drug cartels Kamali had asked for help, and why. When an old man up in Thessaloniki had heard it concerned an American intelligence agent, he would have been only too happy to agree. "Looking around, too?" I said to the man. "I guess you're with the school group, huh?" I couldn't let them think that I suspected anything. They had to believe that their element of surprise was complete. Otherwise, the Saracen might realize it was a trap. I heard a footstep on gravel. Muscleman was the diversion. The attack was coming from behind. No time to think, just make a decision. Yes or no, launch or not. I pressed a button on the phone, firm and short. It was the right decision. My finger had barely left it when they hit me, two of them, very fast, very hard, halfway to being professional. I was going down to my knees, but before I fell completely, I got one of them in the larynx with the point of my elbow and sent him reeling and gasping in a flood of pain. The other one had me round the neck, driving his fist into my face, and I felt my cheekbone go. I could have retaliated, but I was putting up a show. There was no point in having the crap beaten out of me. I would need all my strength for what was coming. I clutched my cheek and sprawled into the dirt. Already, I was counting. 4 minutes. 240 seconds. 232. 200. The man with the bruised and swollen larynx had stumbled back to join the other attacker, and I glimpsed his face. It was the bull of a man. Squat, with closely cropped hair and a cruelty in his eyes that you rarely saw in men outside of prison. I'd seen him before, his expression too, on a mugshot provided by the Greek police, and I recalled that he had a very thick jacket indeed. It was Patros Nikolaidis, the father of Christos. The old godfather himself had left his walled compound. He and his helper ripped the pistol out of my belt, shredded my shirt, grabbed my crotch, and tore off my shoes to see if I had any concealed weapons. They cut open my pockets and removed my wallet, keys, and phone before Nikolaidis called to Kamali.
You got him?
She tossed him a pair of police-issue steel handcuffs, and he and the helper wrenched my arms behind my back and cuffed my wrists so tight I knew that, in 20 minutes, the tissue would be dying from lack of blood, and I might lose the use of my hands forever. Satisfied that I was immobilized, they got to their feet, picked up their weapons, smashed my cell phone, dropped it next to my discarded Beretta, and puffed themselves up. They spoke in a mix of Greek and Albanian, but it wasn't hard to work out what they were saying. These American agents weren't half as good as they thought they were, especially when they ran up against genuine hard-asses from the Balkans. With that, the old bull stepped forward, a decent Glock pistol in his hand, and looked down at me, hands cuffed, lying with my face in the dirt, and kicked me hard in the ribs with the toe of a steel-capped workman's boot.
"That's for my throat," he rasped,
then motioned to Muscle Man and the helper, both armed with Scorpion machine pistols, to drag me to my feet. I forced back a wave of nausea from the blow to the ribs, stood unsteadily, and looked at Kamali.
"What's happening?" I asked through clenched teeth.
I was gasping, trying to deal with the wild shards of pain in my chest and face. For once, I wasn't faking anything. This was no walk in the park.
178 seconds.
"You shouldn't have crossed the Bulgarian border in your rent-a-car," Kamali said. "That was stupid. It's monitored by cameras equipped with license tag recognition."
She didn't try to keep the note of triumph out of her voice. It was clear. She had outwitted the elite American agent.
"Bulgaria?" I replied. "I've never been to fucking Bulgaria."
She shook her head, sneering.
"And you've never been to Svilengrad, and you don't know about bright light, and an orphanage for a little boy. Your name is Michael John Spitz, and you are an intelligence agent, a member of a special CIA group."
I paused just enough to make it appear as if I had been startled, but was trying to cover it.
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said. "You know I am an FBI agent, here to investigate a... wham!"
The steel-cap boot caught me just under the kneecap, and I dragged in a lungful of air to try to combat the exploding pain. I would have crumpled if Muscle Man and the helper hadn't been holding me.
"Don't fucking lie," Patros Nikolaidis said with a smile.
It was nice to meet a man who enjoyed his work.
132 seconds. Then I saw him.
The most wanted man in the world stepped out of the side passage, leaving the shadows behind, and moving into a wedge of light. He was tall and muscular, just as I had expected a former Muj warrior would be, and not even the cheap western suit he was wearing could conceal the coiled tension in him. Dangerous was the word that instantly came into my pain-racked mind. I looked straight at his dark eyes, and it was impossible not to see the sharp intelligence in them. Be careful, I told myself. Be very careful. His beard was neatly trimmed, the jaw set, the lips drawn in a determined line. He had an authority, a sense of command about him.
I believe you have been looking for me, Mr. Spitz, he said quietly.
My name isn't Spitz, and I have no idea who you...
I saw the bull's boot go back, and I braced myself for the detonation. But the Saracen raised his hand, stopping him.
Please,
he said to me, as if the lies were hurting him.
My sister, praise be unto God, has contacts in Turkish intelligence. She discovered who you really are.
Your sister? I said.
He ignored it.
She knows nothing of my work, and little about me, especially in recent years. But she is aware of what happens to Muslim men hunted by agents like you. The whole Arab world knows.
I am an FBI agent,
I repeated through a red mist of pain.
My name is Brody Wilson. I am investigating a murder.
I don't have much time. I am going to ask you some questions, and you're going to tell me exactly what I need to know. Yes?
How can I tell you? I'm not Spitz. I don't know what we're talking about.
98 seconds. That was all, and Bradley's call couldn't come soon enough. My knee was ballooning up and bringing with it increasing waves of nausea. My chest was a field of pain, and I was finding it increasingly difficult to speak because of my cheek.
Don't put yourself through it, the Saracen said. You are an American, Mr. Spitz, a man without God. When you stand at the abyss, when you're being broken on the wheel, who will you be able to turn to for help? You have made tiny mistakes, left enough evidence in your wake to end up here. No, you're really not that good. Why do you think those mistakes were made? Whose hand was protecting me? Who do you think delivered you to this place? It wasn't Leila al-Nusayri. It was God.
I said nothing, slumping a little as if defeated. Muscle Man and the helper loosened their grip a fraction as they tried to support me, and I launched myself forward, using my head as the only weapon I had, hitting Nikolaidi's face with the top of my skull, splitting his bottom lip, feeling it spurt with warm blood, sending him flying backwards and making him spit 2 lower teeth. Another few seconds wasted.
Come on, Ben. Not long now. Cheat a little.
The bull, bellowing with pain, hurled himself towards me and was only stopped by the Saracen's shoulder as he stepped between us.
We're wasting time,
he said, and looked at Muscle Man and the helper.
Get started.
I would have liked to have kept chatting. I would have liked to have chatted for another 63 seconds, but they didn't seem interested. The 2 Albanian thugs dragged me back down the passage, and I was confused. I thought they would have had the truck battery or whatever equipment they needed right at hand. The confusion vanished when I saw the overflowing marble trough and realized what it meant. Mentally, desperately, I tried to shift gears. I had prepared myself for pain, not terror. I had figured I could withstand the alligator clips or pliers ripping out my fingernails for a brief amount of time. But now I dragged my feet, trying to run the clock down. Every second was going to count. If I started to talk, everything would be lost. 42 seconds. The drug courier at Kunyam, the tough guy with the machete scars across his chest, had lasted 29. The Saracen stopped at the marble trough and spoke to his sister in Arabic. I couldn't understand the words, but his hand motion was eloquent enough. He was telling her to take a walk. What was about to happen was not suitable for a woman to witness. 38 seconds. Don't let me down, Ben. Chapter 33. Bradley was timing it too, but he was using a watch, so his count was different, and more accurate than mine. He figured 46 seconds. The obese nanny was drenched in sweat, and her legs looked as if they were going to buckle at any moment. Worse still, she was standing in a pool of urine. She had peed herself the moment she realized what Bradley had in mind. At gunpoint, working to my instructions, he had ordered her and the little guy into the center of the room, directly under the sturdy roof beam. Now, 7 minutes later, the woman continued to whimper and beg for help in Turkish, and though the boy had overcome his first fit of fear and yelling, he was still crying and asking for his mother. The whole event was tearing Bradley's nerves to shreds, and when he wasn't checking his watch, he stared at the floor looking as if he was going to vomit. Despite her distress, the nanny noticed it and couldn't work it out. Maybe he wasn't such a bad man after all. It encouraged her again to muster her limited English and implore him to release them.
"Quiet!"
Bradley yelled, repeating it even louder and raising the gun at her when she still wouldn't stop. She shook again with tears. The little guy's sobs grew more pitiful, and all Bradley wanted to do was to get it over with. It was ahead of time, but he took the nanny's phone off the charger, and despite my insistence that he had to stick absolutely to the schedule, he rationalized it by telling himself it would take time to dial Kamali's cell phone, and there would be a delay while she answered. It rang 4 times. "Come on, come on." It answered. "Thank God," he thought, and he heard a woman's voice speaking in Turkish. He only caught a few words before he talked loudly over her, asking if it was Leyla Kemali and telling her to listen carefully. The woman kept speaking, her tone unaffected. It was as if she was a... Bradley realized. It was an automated voice. The nanny, tottering on her feet, all 300 pounds of her bearing down on her weak knees, saw through her tears that something was badly wrong. Bradley was close to panic. He was breathing hard, not saying a word. The voice was speaking in a language he didn't understand. He had no way of deciphering it, and he didn't know what to do. This wasn't in the manual. Where the hell was the Turkish cop? He looked at his watch. 32 seconds until the 4 minutes was up. He was about to hang up and try again when the voice, out of courtesy to the phone company's customers, repeated the message in English. "The subscriber you are calling is either out of cellular range or has their mobile phone switched off." Bradley lowered the phone and stared into space. Oh, Jesus. Chapter 34. Kamali had walked down a flight of broken marble steps and entered an area which, more than any other, had attracted legions of archaeologists and historians to the ruins. Deep underground, in a vaulted space still decorated with fragments of mosaics and frescoes, she stood beside a reflecting pool, its surface as still as death. It was the centerpiece of what had once been a temple, a place where the highest officials made offerings to their gods in thanks for a safe journey. Kamali had first seen it years before, and had returned to its mysterious beauty in the belief that being so far underground would make it impossible to hear Spitz's screams and desperate pleas. She didn't realize it, but the subterranean space was equally good at deadening cell phone reception. She stared at her face in the mirror like water, telling herself that whatever her brother was doing to the American was a little different from what had been visited upon Muslim men at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. Bright light, too. Comforted by the thought, she walked on, past the end of the reflecting pool, and headed deeper into the temple's catacomb-like passages. No sound or signal would ever find her there. Chapter 35. Muscleman and the helper had retrieved a short wooden plank that had been hidden among the mound of rubble and trash. I fought and struggled, trying to chew up time, but my injured knee and the pain in my chest meant they had little trouble binding me to the wood with heavy leather straps. I was face up, trussed so tight I couldn't move, when the Saracen's face appeared above me. Impassive, his hand reaching down and taking my wrist. He was a doctor, and he was checking my pulse. He gave a grunt of satisfaction. He knew from my heart rate I was scared. He pointed at Nikolaides.
When I'm finished, he told me, the man with the dental problem will question you about a murder your intelligence agencies committed in Santorini. He wants to know who ordered the attack and the names of those who did the killing. You understand?
Santorini? I don't know anything about Santorini.
They didn't look convinced. Nikolaides threw a bucket to Muscleman and picked up a length of dirty towel from the rubble. They were about to start. The Saracen kept looking at me.
You can avoid this, he told me.
I said nothing, and he shrugged.
When I was in the Hindu Kush, some people helped me. As you know, one of them has decided to betray us. Obviously, I can't allow that to happen. I want you to tell me the name of the traitor.
Even if I knew it, I replied, once I told you, you'd just kill me.
He nodded.
I'm going to kill you anyway.
Figured. Otherwise, you'd be trying to hide your faces.
My best guess was that I would end up in a waterproof shroud, probably already hidden in a locker on the half-cabin cruiser, and it would likely be years before a fisherman finally hauled it aboard. If Ben didn't come through, I just hoped I was dead before they put me inside.
If you know you're going to die, what's the point of suffering first? The name, Mr. Spitz.
I'm an FBI agent. I came to Bodrum to...
I've seen an email,
he snapped, his face coming close to mine.
From the deputy director of the CIA.
I did my best to look shocked. He registered it and smiled.
Now, the name of the traitor.
I'm an FBI agent.
Exasperated, he signaled to Nikolaides. The Greek wrapped the dirty towel over my face, covering my eyes and nose, jamming my mouth open. Nikolaides took both ends of the rag behind the plank and tied it tight. I was in darkness, already finding it difficult to breathe, my head bound so firmly to the plank I couldn't move. I felt them lift me, and in my private blackness and terror, I knew they had me suspended over the water. 29 seconds by my count. The same amount of time the drug courier had endured. Despite my own weaknesses, even though I had always doubted my courage, I only had to withstand it for as long as he did. They started to lower me down, and I dragged in a breath. The towel stank of sweat and engine oil. The last thing I heard was the Saracen.
You're shaking, Mr. Spitz.
Then the water hit me. Chapter 36. It washed over my torso as the plank sank into the trough, chilling my genitals and aggravating the open wound on my chest. I dropped lower, helpless, and felt the tide hit the back of my strapped skull and cover my ears. Then they tilted the plank backwards. Water flooded across my face. Trying not to panic, unable to use my arms or twist my body, I took another huge gulp of oil-stained air and only succeeded in sucking the moisture faster through the towel. Water ran down my throat, and I started to cough. A wall of water hit my face, and I wasn't coughing anymore. I was choking. In darkness, my head tilted back. I had no idea whether the water had come from a bucket or if they had plunged me deeper into the bath. The sensation of drowning, of a terrifying need to drag air through the sodden towel, was overwhelming. Instead, fluid was flooding into my nostrils and mouth and running down my steeply inclined throat. The gag reflex kicked in, trying to save me, and became a rolling thunder of spasms and choking. More and more water was hitting me, and I was becoming disoriented. I had only one thought, one belief, one truth to cling to. 18 seconds and Bradley would call. 17 seconds and salvation would be at hand. 16. I was bound so tight I couldn't thrash and kick despite the cascading terror. More water entered my nose and mouth, seemingly drowning me, and the constant gagging and spasms were turning my throat raw. I would have screamed, but the filthy towel and surging water prevented even that release. With no way to express itself, my terror turned inward and reverberated through the hollow chambers of my heart. My legs and back jerked instinctively, trying to make me flee, using up precious energy, and I felt myself being tilted further backwards. Water swamped me. Another surge of gagging hit. Where was Bradley? He had to call. A fragment of my whirling mind told me I had lost count of time. How many seconds? There was nothing but blackness and the desperate urge to breathe. To endure, to survive, not to falter, was all that was left. I spun through darkness and overwhelming fear. My head was tilted even further back, and I was plunging down. Maybe it was just another huge bucketful of water, but I felt as if I was deep under the surface, choking, gasping, and retching in a watery grave, desperate for air, desperate for life. I knew I could endure no more, but suddenly I was rocketing up, the water draining off my face, and I could drag air through the towel. It was tiny and insignificant, but it was a breath. It was life, and they were standing me upright. Bradley had called. He must have. I tried to suck more air into my throat. I had to be ready to play my part, but I kept gasping and retching. Then the towel was gone, and I was pulling in breaths as my chest kept heaving and my windpipe shuddering and spasming. I knew that I had to control it. I had to be in command. By God, it was the Saracen's turn now to sit down to a banquet of consequences. A hand slid inside my shredded shirt. I blinked the water from my eyes and saw that it was him, checking the rhythm and strength of my heartbeat. I caught sight of the old bull standing behind him, laughing at me through his stained teeth, enjoying my distress and fear. A surge of wild panic tore through me. Nobody was acting as if the tables had been turned. I knew then that there had been no phone call. Where the hell was Ben? I slumped. I was alone in the theater of death, and this time I really was dying to the world. I would have fallen to the ground, but Muscle Man and the Helper were holding the board and kept me upright.
"The name of the traitor?"
the Saracen asked. I tried to speak, but my throat was ripped raw, and my mind, awash with adrenaline and cortisol, was struggling. Instead, staring down at the ground, I just shook my head. No, I wouldn't be telling him any name.
"That was 37 seconds, he replied. "It was longer than average, and you should be proud. You've done as much as anyone could expect. But it can go on for minutes if we like. Everybody breaks. Nobody can win. What is the name?"
My hands were shaking, and I didn't seem able to stop them. I looked up and tried to speak again. The first syllable was so soft it was inaudible, and the Saracen leaned in close so that he could hear.
"Put the towel back on," I whispered.
He backhanded me hard across the face, splitting my lip. But he couldn't scare me anymore. In a corner of my mind, I had found a small reservoir of courage. I was thinking about Ben Bradley and those 67 floors. Muscle Man and the Helper upended the plank and carried me back to the trough. The Saracen was about to reattach the towel when Nicolaides called out, telling him to step aside. I saw that he had picked up a stonemason's hand hammer, a heavy, brutal thing, from among the equipment they had hidden next to the rubble. When I was flat on the board, my shoeless feet directly in front of him, he pulled his powerful shoulders back and swung as hard as he could. The hammer hit me full force on the sole of my left foot, bursting the flesh and crushing the matrix of tiny bones and joints. A searing, vomit-laden flash of pain, like a massive electric spear, went through my shin, up my leg, and into my groin. He might as well have been crushing my testicles. I would have passed out, but somehow my howling scream tethered me to consciousness. Nicolaides laughed.
"See, his voice is stronger already," he said to the Saracen. "Sometimes the old ways are still the best ways."
He hit me again. It was closer to my toes. I heard more bones crunch, and I screamed even louder. I was going over the waterfall into unconsciousness, but the Helper, standing next to my head and cheering the old bull on, slapped me hard across the face to keep me in the present. He called to the bull,
"Another one!"
"No," ordered the Saracen. "This has taken too long already.
If he passes out, we'll be here all day.
He turned to me.
Tell me the name now.
I am Brody David Wilson. I am an FBI